Our subject today is chapter 8, which is virtue. There's three chapters that deal with ethics. 7 is the foundation, the base. 8 is the means in detail. How in detail you have to live to achieve the goal outlined in 7. And then 9 is the cashing in, the rewards, the payoff. So in terms of detailed practical guidance, 8 is definitely the most significant. Philosophically, it's not, because the foundation is more important than the derivatives. But in terms of actual cash value guidance, there's more ethical guidance in 8 than in all the rest. Now, this is my personal second favorite chapter. My favorite chapter in the book is 4 on objectivity, which most of you haven't seen. This chapter has quite a bit that is new in it that wasn't in the literature before. And I personally learned the most from writing this chapter than from any other chapter. Now, if anyone had told me when I started the book that the chapter on virtue would be the most illuminating one, I would have thought that's fantastic, you know, because all it is a detailed chewing of what is rationality. But it really was a turning point for me. If any of you know what Miss Rand called the squirms, that's the process where you're trying to write and you're completely paralyzed and blocked, so you're squirmed, and you can neither put anything down that makes any sense nor stop writing, and you feel like you don't understand anything, whatever. And I was blessing this book, in contrast to the Ominous Parallels, which I had squirms about every 5 pages on, but I was just sailing along and everything was great. You know, any given point might be complex or difficult, but there was none of that absolute paralysis and total despair until I got to independence and integrity and broke down completely, which was baffling to me at the time because, in theory, these are very easy, straightforward applications. Why there? In fact, it got so bad that I actually left town for a while because I simply couldn't face being in the same city as the desk where I had to. In any event, the happy result was that I resolved what the problem was finally after quite a long time and had to rewrite the whole book up to that point, essentially, to catch it up to what I then saw. And it never happened again. I had only one paralysis on this book, but that was the real killer. And it centered on independence and integrity, so that those two plus honesty are by far the most interesting to me because of what I learned from them that I hadn't expected. Now, I've given already at TJS 2 years ago a lecture on independence, and I actually indicated how I had presented it the first time around, why I had disliked it, and then what I discovered, and how I finally came to present it. So I can't repeat all that material now. Suffice it to say, on the issue of independence, I learned what I call the PIE idea, P-I-E. That is, when I first began, somebody's beeper is beeping. Oh, that's right. Oh, they're going backwards in construction. Yeah. When I first began to present these virtues, I had in mind that there was 2 aspects to each virtue: an intellectual side, a certain course of consciousness, and then an existential action side, a certain course of actual behavior in the world. And that was, to me, what you presented for each virtue. So it was very simple. I gave the definition, and then I said intellectually it means so and so and so, and then existentially so and so and so. And I discovered, as I said, you can rehear this old lecture if you want the details, that this was a hopeless and mistaken, wrong-headed method of approaching the virtues because it amounted to 2 concretes. In your mind, do so and so. In action, do so and so. All right, now let's go to the next one. With 2 commandments in again, without any tie-in between the 2 commandments, and nor therefore any integration to the base of philosophy, to metaphysics and epistemology. Each were kind of self-contained, quote, common sense. They missed out whatever was distinctive to objectivism, and by the nature of the approach, they were plagued with confusions and non sequiturs. And what I finally discovered is that both the intellectual and the existential side of each virtue are two concretes, two applications of what? Of a principle which is broader than either intellectual or existential, which covers any and every aspect of human functioning. So that's what I call a piece, a principle. And therefore, if you look at the virtues now, you will see that every one is first the principle, and then, you know, maybe take two pages or five or whatever, then the intellectual application. What does this mean as far as consciousness? And then the existential stuff, P-I-E. See, that's how I thought of it in my own mind. I actually had to go over the whole chapter which had been written and cut up each paragraph and decide, does this, and sometimes it was even a sentence or a phrase, does this part of the principle or where does it go? And then shuffle them all up and do it over again. But to put it another way, this virtue taught me how to think in principle in a way that I had thought I was doing. But it made tremendously clear the distinction between a principle and an application, a concrete, an instance of that principle. And since I had to do it on six consecutive virtues, it really hammered into my mind for all topics, when are you thinking in principle and when are you simply applying the principle. So as an exercise, it would be worth it for you to go over these and see if you can draw the line where the P stops and where the I stops. Get the pi structure, because they definitely have it. So I think of independence as the virtue that taught me to think in principle. And it entailed corresponding revisions of the earlier material. Now that I was sharp on that distinction between principle and example, I kept asking, well, is this really a principle, or is this an example, or have I mixed the two? Now, integrity was very valuable to me because it made clear why action on principle was a necessity. It was the same issue of principle, but in independence I was working to figure out how to think in principle, how to organize intellectual material. And the substance of integrity is why you have to act on principle. So the two together were a tremendous complement to each other. And I then finally understood, when I grasped why action on principle is a necessity, I understood why evil is impotent, whereas the good has to be consistent. Once I grasped the issue of principle, then I could see evil can't act on principle, it has to be inconsistent. Whereas if the good has to be consistent, see, it fell into place necessarily. So the only last thing I really needed was to tie my principles to reality. And that's what honesty provided. It was fascinating to me that those three virtues functioned to guide thought, action, and then to tie the whole thing to the primary, which was reality. And how do I get reality? Because the key thing in regard to honesty was that you can't achieve a value through fraud. And this was the line of Miss Rand's, I think it's now page 338, that had always intrigued but baffled me because I never entirely understood it. At the very bottom of 338, the unreal is unreal and can have no value, but neither love nor fame nor cash is of value if obtained by fraud. Now, you know, that was really hard for me for a long time to understand, because I would have said, well, it's a value, for instance, if you're given $1 million, but you got it the wrong way, or you'll pay for it by, you know, suffering and bad consequences in the future, but at least in and of itself, to that extent, you're better off having it than not having it, so it's a value, and I could never understand that Well, I finally did understand why reality has to be the base of all evaluations, and why if you drop reference to reality, you make reality in any form your enemy, there's no further possibility of any evaluation. You cannot say that $1 million is good or bad. We'll look at that when we get there. And of course, when I grasped that evaluation has to be based on reality, it was easy enough to see that the same thing was true more broadly of all principles and not merely evaluation. So from the sum of these three virtues, I got the message through to myself: you have to think in principle, you have to act on principle, and your principles have to be derived from reality. Those are the three consecutive, and when I finally got that, you know, I would have lectured on that for years and thought I was perfectly clear, but it obviously wasn't. But when I finally got it established in written form, it was like a window into the total of objectivism. I could retroactively understand the basic philosophy and then in the other direction understand the practical. And that's why I think of this chapter as a turning point. It was like a special training in all the essentials of a proper approach to life. I didn't learn a comparable amount from any other chapter or section. You know, I could learn an individual point here or there, but I didn't have like successive revelations of, oh, now I really get it, the way I did with these three. So I have a special fondness for these three virtues. Now, just one other preliminary point before we turn to the virtues one at a time. I'd like you to note the stress I place on the integration or interconnection of all the virtues. That is, both in theory and in practice, they are all bound together. None can be validated by itself apart from the others, and none can be practiced by itself apart from the others. Now, I mention this because particularly philosophy students try to find a self-contained proof, you can airtight deductive proof of any given one virtue, and they come in and they say without context, why should you be honest? And they want you to say, well, because and such, regardless of whether you should have integrity or should use force, they think you can leave all those questions open and just address the question, why should you be honest, and give a deductive or some type of definitive proof. And in fact, I think someone sitting over there tried to do that with force the other day. And he wanted to know, when you're trying to prove the evil of force, do you deduce it from this point or from this point? Now, the whole essence is this: there's only one virtue, and that is rationality. All the rest of these are forms or applications of rationality. So you cannot take one aspect out of the context of the rest and say, now prove this one. If the abstract proof of rationality is not enough for you, then you're going to have to treat every single aspect interconnected with all the others, you see. It would be like, why should you be reasonable in regard to bananas? Now forget about peaches, pears, nutrition, vitamins. We're not talking about all that. I want a proof as to why you should eat only ripe bananas. And you know, whatever you say, I say, well, that also takes into account peaches. I want banana. Well, you can't. There is no unique proof that applies only to yellow fruit from the tropics. So if you try to do that, you'll make some horrible construct up, which someone could easily destroy. Well, you have to think of all the virtues like the field of nutrition. It's all interconnected. You can focus on one aspect, but only remembering that it only stands within the context of the total. And in connection with ethics, it's not only that all the virtues are interconnected, all of them rest on a certain metaphysics and epistemology. And I do try to indicate for every virtue in what way it goes back to a certain metaphysics and epistemology. Now, there are times, there are audiences in which you take the line that objectivism is really merely common sense. And there's a way in which, you know, in a delimited square, you can present it that way. You could say, well, after all, objectivism says, work for a living. Who could disagree with that? Practice what you preach. Don't be a hypocrite. That's integrity, you know. And you can turn it all into a kind of, you know, common sense formulation that is more or less innocuous. But the point I want you to see from this chapter is that these common sense formulations cannot be fully understood or even practiced, not fully, except if a person grasps the nature of reality and of concepts, those two. If he's off significantly in either of those fundamental areas, reality or cognition, specifically concepts, then no matter how much common sense, good ethics he holds, he's going to be thrown off in understanding, applying, or implementing his good ideas. And therefore, this chapter should also be a good demonstration to you of the role of fundamentals in life and why an entire philosophy is necessary to save the world. Not only it's politics is not enough, but ethics is not enough. Ethics can't even be interpreted or understood except by relation to a fundamental philosophy. All right, that's by way of an overview. Now let's turn, well, we're really not going to do independence, but we'll sort of do a hit and run on this. I just wanted to show you a couple of the points that I just made as applied to this virtue. Now, if you turn to 328, you'll see paragraph 3, the relationship between the virtue of independence and the fundamentals of metaphysics and epistemology and ethics is readily apparent. Now, that, of course, is an outright lie because I didn't have a clue when I did it the first time. But when I finally figured it out, it's readily apparent. Now, I don't write that same sentence on every virtue, but on every virtue I try to point out, in some terms, in what way it goes back to fundamentals. And here you see it tie into the metaphysical and the man-made, the primacy of existence, reason, and even the issue of egoism, which is a fundamental in ethics. I mean, part of the base. So try to isolate that in regard to each virtue, just as exercise if you want. Now, just to tell you, where do you think the P ends and the PIE structure in this chapter of independence, in this sequence? What is the end of the broad principle of independence? The principle, by the way, is basically given in the subtitle. Now, you see the difference between the subtitle and the definition that Miss Rand gave, which is at the beginning of the sequence on independence. See the difference? Now, there she gave the intellectual and the existential side together, because she was not trying there to go into a dissertation. She wanted just a line to capture the point she needed for her context. So she did not give the principle there. She gave two aspects. But the principle that I abstracted, I indicated in the subtitles. So sometimes the subtitles are more instructive than the stuff I write. And where does the general discussion of reality versus others, whether intellectual, existential, or pineapple, where does this broad discussion cease? Yes.
In the middle of page
329 is the end of the principle. And then, of course, I give it away because I say, like every virtue, it involves both an intellectual and existential. So that's, from there, it doesn't take much brains. But up to that point, we're talking of that which validates both intellectual and existential independence. Why your orientation must be reality. Whether it's intellectual, whether it's truth, or material values, you see, must be reality and not others. And that is discussed in those broad terms and related to the metaphysics and epistemology of the philosophy. And only then do we say, now let's come down to the humdrum, banal details of daily life. Should you listen to your uncle just because he said it? Well, obviously you shouldn't. You should think on your own. You see, but we're just now applying. There's no longer any bombshell because the substance has been given in the first part. And I more and more come to think that that is the way to think about any question, and that it's a real skill to be able to tell when you're thinking in principles and when you're lost in the concrete. All right, that's all I want to say about independence. Does anybody want to ask anything about independence?
Extended critique of altruism. Now, Ayn Rand was the outstanding critic of altruism, and I understand your desire to keep away from polemics. Why doesn't the book contain more discussion of altruism itself?
Well, fine. Why doesn't the book contain a more extended polemic against altruism, since that was one of Ayn Rand's most famous unique points? Well, it's partly what you say. It's partly because it's polemical, and I defined my purpose in the beginning as to do polemics only very briefly. By the way, if I were to have included it, it would have to be in the preceding chapter, not in this one, because then it would be the denial of egoism, so the polemic against altruism would properly have gone in that section. But the true answer is this. I couldn't think of a single solitary thing to say against altruism that she hadn't already said. Not one thing. There was no aspect, no virtue, no value, no historical era, no figure, no example. And I said in the book what the actual truth was. That if anybody knew her work and still felt they need to hear another point or another argument against altruism, I mean, there's nothing I could do for them. I know right now as a certainty that if I talk till I die, if Ayn Rand's collected works didn't convince someone on that point, nothing I said till I died would convince them either. So in other words, I only went into something in this book if I felt there was some sort of clarification, particularly if it was a negative or a polemical, some kind of additional point I could make. But there, precisely because she covered it so extensively and so thoroughly, I had nothing to say, and I actually said that in the book. And basically, the same thing was true of statism. I mean, she made the case against that so extensively that, you know, I come in and say, well, I'll just supplement it by throwing in another argument against dictatorship. It would be ridiculous. Now, on the other hand, on the more technical things, she left her objections often to implication, you know. So then there was more of a room to develop. But altruism, I would give you as an assignment, go home and come up with one page of polemics that is not either verbatim or a paraphrase of something in her book. If you can do it, you know, more power to you. That's, I couldn't. You could give examples, but examples are not, you know, in the nature of the book. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. You do it.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. In the beginning of the chapter on virtue, you said that the six virtues you're discussing are not an exhaustive list of virtues. There have been people claiming recently that objectivism holds that it is, and that it leaves out other alleged virtues like toleration and so forth.
Oh, please,
and
yeah.
What constitute an additional virtue, and how would you judge it?
Well, I mean, you're asking me to do exactly what Ayn Rand didn't do, and which is not part of objectivism. It would have to be part of the next generation if somebody wanted to work it out. She's asking me, why is this not an exhaustive list of virtues? Does it? What about toleration, or how would you know what else might be a virtue? First of all, toleration is out of the question because it's a vice, as these people define it. It's just subjectivism and the refraining of from moral judgment. So it's injustice and subjectivism, you know, in the name of either belonging or having power. So the whole thing is just a total corruption. But more broadly, I had a discussion with Ayn Rand once, and I said, why would you not say this is the exhaustive list? She said, if you wanted to say this is the total list, you would have to make up one of those dichotomies, you know, that human life consists of A or non-A. Now, within non-A, it obviously has to be B or non-B, and within non-B, so on. so that at the end, you know that every single issue and area of human life has been covered. Now, she said, all I did is take the issues that, from my observation, I know are fundamental and recurrent, in other words, essential to the living of human life. I have not tried to think, are there other applications of rationality, which are important, which need a separate discussion, you know. I'm not purporting to have given the total. You'd have to work out some scheme, you see, by which you would demonstrate that this covers the total. And she wanted to give you the essential guidance that she knew was necessary. She was not creating a philosophic system. I mean, in that way, you know, like Kant or whoever were, they have it all worked out, and there are three of type A and three of type B. Then you go to the grocers and get type C, you know, that all matches and so on. It's not necessarily a misbegotten attempt, but what you would have to do is what I said, and you'd have to be able to prove that what you're arguing for is in fact not reducible to one of the ones that are already covered, is an expression of rationality, and then you would have to have something to say about it. You'd have to show that it illuminates a whole area, and there's be a lot of questions like courage and confidence, which she subsumes under, I believe, integrity. You could conceivably give them more space, you know, or what the Greeks used to call temperance, which was not, you know, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, but, you know, in effect, rationality in regard to material pleasures and welfare, well-being, you know, as opposed to overeating and all that type of thing. It becomes a question of classification there. She said she regards rationality as sufficient to cover that, but she wouldn't necessarily be opposed if someone could define it, validate it objectively, show that it's a form of rationality, and integrate it to the rest. Only she didn't see that there was any point to doing so within the knowledge that she already had. So that's basically is the answer. But she did insist to me that she does not say it's exhaustive, nor was there a logical necessity in the sequence. You know, I tried many times to prove that you had to go from independence to integrity, but she kept saying it's one total. You know, and there's a certain reason why. You can see a logic to the progression, but it's just, you know, an expositional rather than a mandatory progression. Well, I think we've given independence ample time. You can always come back and throw in. Now, let's look at integrity. Now, again, integrity, the subtitle, in many cases, my subtitles are the most valuable thing in the sequence. Because if you notice the difference, the definition is loyalty in action to one's convictions and values. But I put it as loyalty to rational principles. Now the question is, how do you get from, let's say, loyalty to your values to loyalty to principles? And that's the question I had to wrestle with, and that's what finally made clear to me the need of principled action. I didn't see why being faithful to your values entailed your commitment to principle. Now, does anybody have a clue as to how you get from one to the other? Why does loyalty to your values mean commitment to a set of principles? I see a hand wave. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Otherwise, they can't be long range.
All right, otherwise they can't be long range. Why not? So you just need one more sentence. That's right. That's true. And we learned in chapter 7 that the only way you can attain the long range, keep your direction, know the consequences of your actions, foresee them, is through the guidance of
principle.
Well, don't throw reason. Reason is too abstract. Principle here is what we want. Certain fundamental generalizations, which is what a code of ethics will give you. But of course, ethics is not the only principle. There may be other types of principle beyond ethical that you need in order to be loyal to a certain value. But the point is, without principles, you cannot be loyal to any value or conviction that extends beyond, you know, the whim of any given moment. Suppose you say, for instance, well, I don't care about principles. But I'm going to have integrity in regard to my child. I'm always going to be loyal to my child. I'm never going to, you know, sacrifice him or her or harm them. That, on that you can count on me as a man of integrity. But I'm doing it without principle. So I won't be a hypocrite or anything. What is the immediate question? The immediate question the person has to ask. I'm trying to get different. You're supposed to. Yeah.
I don't see the hand.
How are you going to do it?
Exactly. How are you going to know what loyalty to this value consists of? I mean, for instance, you have to educate the child. That's part of being loyal, but what kind of education? What's the nature of the child? What kind of education does the child need? That already takes you into the whole field of educational principles in order to be loyal. And at the same time, you got to feed the child, so you have to know something about nutritional principles. You can't give him only candy because that's all he wants. Otherwise, you are subverting the very thing you're supposedly being loyal to. And what other needs does he have? Does he need friends? If so, a certain kind. Then you have obligation of the kind of friends. You have to live in the kind of location where he has access to friends. And what kind of friends? All of that. I mean, it's a massive amount of knowledge, ethical and also non-ethical, psychological, educational, to figure out what is required simply to remain true to this value. As against, well, yeah, I'm going to be loyal to this value, and then just let it run wild without any content, you see. It's, if you do that, however well-meaning you are, you're going to end up harming and ultimately destroying the value. So, if you work it out, you would see, but you should see from the very nature of principles in human life, you cannot be loyal to any idea or value except within the framework of a code of principles which will enable you to deal with the vast data that come at you and shape them, react to them, act on them in accordance with the demands of that loyalty. And that is why the official definition reduces to integrity as loyalty to rational principles. And as soon as I grasped that, I saw, God, principles are everywhere. You have to think in terms of them, you have to act in terms of them, and it kind of, it, you see how it was all hammered home. Now, the one other thing that I wanted to point out is, in regard to integrity, is Miss Rand's attitude to temptation. One of the very first things that she said to me, the first or second night that we met, was that people will be very surprised by her ethics because it has no duties and no discussion of how to resist temptation. And she was right, of course. I couldn't even imagine such a thing because the idea of virtue is, in most people's minds, resisting, fighting down temptation. And in fact, the nature of your self-sacrifice in many cases is supposed to be give up what you want in order to be moral. Now, you know why Ayn Rand rejected that out of hand. She didn't accept self-sacrifice, and all of ethics was to your interest. So if you understood this and you wanted to live, you couldn't possibly be tempted, and therefore there's nothing to fight back. Except, she always pointed out, you can be tempted out of context, and this can happen entirely innocently and even to the very best imaginable person. And she put a scene in Atlas Shrugged deliberately so that she would be on the record of showing her top hero beset by temptation out of context. And which scene is that? That's right. Galt coming to see Reardon and envying him because, you know, he was the top executive living in that world, and here Galt was consigned to the nameless and unrecognized underground. And of course, then she shows him recapturing the context and seeing the full truth, and he went on. But imagine the tragedy if he had believed that the thing to do in the face of temptation is repress it, push it down and go on blindly despite your desire. Well, it wouldn't take very long before he would, I don't know how to put it nicely, destroy himself, I guess is the best way to put it. Now, the best paragraph that I have on this point is on page 334, the second paragraph. And that is, I thought this was a good way of capturing the point. That there is a challenge in life, but the challenge is not to struggle against immoral passions, but to see the facts of reality clearly. Because that is a struggle. That's volitional, and it can be very difficult. You don't even know what they are in any given situation. But the objectivist viewpoint is once in a given situation you have seen the facts, there is no further problem in regard to doing what you see has to be done. It's getting to see it that's the problem. The problem is cognitive. There's no separate problem of, well, I know the truth, but somehow I just can't act on it. That would only be possible to an anti-life code of ethics, which makes a conflict between your desires and your knowledge, but it couldn't be for objectivism. Now, you'll notice that, you probably notice that there's a lot more examples in this virtue than in most, and that, if anybody knows me, means I was having more trouble than with most, and I took the view that if I needed five or whatever number of examples, I'm throwing them in because there must be some reason why is this confusing to me, So in most virtues, I just, give an example and go on. But here I say, here's one, and now let's take a different example. Now let's look at this example. And that, is a residue of the fact that I was a little shaky. So I wanted to keep on coming at it from different points of view till I finally could hammer it home. So those of you in this instance who are ahead of me, who understood the point from the beginning, may find that it bogs down a little bit in too many examples. I would accept that criticism, but I started out with the idea what I needed 20 years ago, and if I still needed it last year, I left it in. And then on 336, I had a very big problem with this second last paragraph, or rather with the topic involved, because it kept in my own mind seeming as though evil was more powerful than good. The idea was the devil is so strong that he can compromise and still win. And virtue somehow is so weak that if it yields one inch, it'll be overcome altogether. And I couldn't break from my mind this model that there is somehow more power on the side, more freedom and flexibility on the side of evil, and more fear and inadequacy on the side of good. And I just couldn't get that through my head. And then, of course, finally, I got the idea, and that was a big turning point, that the very nature of evil requires it to be flexible, and the very nature of good prohibits it from being that. And then that the reason is because evil is powerless, and therefore it has to be inconsistent, it has to be parasitical on the good. So evil is delighted to make a deal. That's the only way it can function. That's its life breath, you see. I think that's all explained pretty clearly here. And this is a good paragraph, I think. Fourth from the bottom on 337. That about why evil has to be partial, occasional, great. And then a liar is not a man who always conscientiously tells falsehoods. Just a few whoppers is enough. And the same with a hypocrite. A burglar isn't someone who steals every item of property he sees. Just as a person is a killer, even if he respects human life 99.9% of the time, and he hires himself out as an executioner only occasionally. See, the issue is that, well, it's clear that evil is not consistent and doesn't want to be consistent. Okay, I think we'll let you ask on integrity.
This is a little bit further back, but you say on page 301 that...
301? Yeah.
Yeah. Every choice redounds on one's ability to survive, even taking a nap.
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
Things like that. And if motion is not self-preserving, then self-destroying. What I'm wondering is, if I specify a normal context of taking a nap, I'm not working, I'm not driving, then it seems to me that that's optional. And one can make many small, very tiny decisions wrong and does so all the time if they're all impacting one's
survival. Give me an example of a wrong optional decision, because I'm not sure I understand. It's both optional and wrong.
I'm saying it turns out to be wrong. You just did it in a hurry.
Oh, well, that's okay. Let me maybe, Phil, correct your question this way. There's nothing in the paragraph that you're mentioning on page 301 about that life demands all-embracing course. That is not the same as saying life demands omniscience, or that life demands that every decision you make be right. What it does say is that you have to make decisions by a certain method, which method will enable you to see the mistakes if and when you made them. So if there are bad consequences, you're in a position to put an end to them right at that time by catching. So if you do something optional without knowledge, for instance, you can go left or right when you come to a bridge, and you know that's the same distance. If you don't happen to know there's a hole, you know, because of a meteor on one side. So you take the optional course and you see the hole. Now you did something wrong. You are able to stop the consequences, or hopefully leap out of the car, minimize them. You see, so there's nothing in that to say that you can take an action without a consequence. Whatever you do is going to have a consequence. And you may do something perfectly honestly that has a bad consequence, but then you will discover the consequence. What you will not find is an action that has no consequence unless you reduce it beyond the limit of the normal perceptual context. For instance, I can think of a lot of choices that have no consequences whatever, because in the normal context they are not a choice. But you could make them into a choice if you want, just as a game, unless you do that too much, you know, and you flip out mentally. But for instance, I could start to fall asleep, and my hand would fall on the cover, say, and then I would think to myself, now do I want the index finger or the third finger to press more closely into the couch, you know, or the fourth finger? Now, if I get involved in that, which is not an actual choice because it's of no consequence, it's of no significance, but if you get yourself involved in that, you know, within limits, you could say you have a choice that makes no difference. But the danger there is, if you start to make that kind of choice, you're introducing another principle governing your behavior, which is that you're challenging the automatic for no reason. And that is going to impair your functioning in all kinds of other ways. So even though that consequence doesn't have a consequence, your method of approach has one. Now, I know you can go back and forth on this, but that's as much as I want right here, because we're back on an earlier chapter. But think about that for this point. Let's take one more on integrity.
Ed?
In We the Living, Andre was portrayed as having a certain integrity.
Oh, yeah.
And I heard later that Ms. Rand considered him the most unrealistic character in the book. Was that because, in reality, a communist couldn't have integrity? If so...
Yes, she presented Andre as the honest, idealistic communist. And he, therefore, certainly was presented as a man of integrity. When he thought that communism was the ideal, he acted accordingly, doing the most extreme action. At the moment that he came to see that it wasn't, he renounced it, denounced it, you know, and ended up taking his life. So in that sense, he was completely consistent in his action with his convictions, and he certainly functioned by principle. It is true, as you say, Ed, that Ms. Rand regarded him as unrealistic character, because she did not believe that anyone could get on the in of the Communist Party, behind the scenes, and engage and know about the GPU, you know, tortures and so on, without grasping what it was, and therefore that any honest man would actually be repelled by it. But she was trying to stretch, you know, stretch enormously a certain point to try to just abstract what if someone had. But she always said that it really was impossible in Russia, and this is even in the, you know, at the time of the revolution, let alone, you know, in America 4 decades later, you know, when they were going strong and preaching how good it was. But no, all of her characters have integrity.
Believed in communism, say, it wasn't like in America in the 30s. Could an honest person have believed in communism at all?
Well, that's a good transition to honesty, so let's go to honesty. Could an honest person have believed in communism in what period? In America.
30s.
America in the 30s. That entirely depends on what you mean by believe in communism. There are honest people with very bad thinking methods whose idea of believing in communism in the 30s would be something like, we got a lot of social problems here, and Russia is trying something different. I don't really know much about it, but it's supposed to make everybody happy. And, you know, if you think on that level, you'd say this person is not a clear thinker, they don't have good thinking methods, and the probability is they're not very conscientious about their thinking. But on the face of it, I wouldn't say this has to be dishonesty or depravity. I would not say that. On the other hand, if the person knows at all what it means to believe in communism and still believes in it, that's definitely dishonest. Or if he lives in a decade such as, you know, let alone the 90s, where even the communists don't believe in it anymore, but, you know, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, where the atrocities around the world have been, you know, broadcast for everyone to know, then it's definitely dishonest. But it's a whole separate question to take a given idea and say, how or when or could a person accept this honestly or not? That's really is a whole separate field in and of itself. And it's sometimes difficult. All right, now let us look at honesty. Again, I partly covered this in past classes. The essence of the argument for honesty, the essence of the case, is a very philosophical paragraph on page 339. And it's the answer to why you can't achieve a value by fraud, by faking. That's the second paragraph on 339. I don't know if it's worth, I'll just reread the highlights of it. If you try to gain a value through fraud, your obstacle is reality. Specifically, the facts that you're trying to get around, that you're trying to fake. So you're making a dichotomy, a conflict, a war between what is and what you want. Between, I'm paraphrasing what I wrote there. Between fact and desire. Which means philosophically you're placing value, you see, you desire what's good, what you're after, above that which exists. And that is the breach with reality. Value, we just said in the preceding paragraph, is a form of truth. It's a form of conceptualization. And therefore it has to correspond to reality. If you try to define or uphold a value that precedes reality, that's above reality, then it's like trying to have an idea which is true first before reality, and if it conflicts with reality, to hell with reality. And obviously, that is impossible. So in the act of trying to say about something, it's good, I want it, apart from the facts of reality, you have annihilated the statement that it's good. Just as you would have if you had said about an idea, it's true. You have deprived it of any evaluative standing because you've disconnected it from reality, so it's outside the realm of values. And therefore, all it can do is what any breach with reality does, bring harmful consequences. Can you just nudge him? The back is for sleeping. Bring harmful consequences to the person and the rest of his life. Now, the other point that I wanted to point out is I'm just on page 341, where I'm stressing again the interdependence of the virtues, in this case, honesty. While you can't be dishonest, but independent, you have integrity, you're productive, you're just, everything is great, it just happens that you lie a lot. Once you're dishonest, you subvert all the other virtues, and that is true throughout. And I work it out there one at a time. And that is that excellent statement of Socrates, virtue is one, which is a very, very profound statement. Socrates, of course, is the first to organize ethical theory, and he made more brilliant statements, and that is one. And a lot of them objectivism would agree with completely. The other point in regard to honesty that I wanted to point out was on 342. The trade-off viewpoint. I'd like you to reject that out of hand. The trade-off viewpoint, you know what that is. That's the idea somebody, you can get $1 million by stealing it, by some form of fraud. So then, whether to do it or not, you make a list. On one side, you put the advantages. And the advantage is $1 million, trip to Hawaii, you know, be popular because you'll give big parties. And you make a whole list. On the other side, you put, but I'll feel a certain amount of guilt, and I might get caught by the police, and so on. They say, now let me weigh. Which of these comes to more? And sometimes the person says, well, I'll put up with the guilt and the police. I'd rather have $1 million. Somebody says, no, I'm afraid of the police, so on. Now, that is what's called the trade-off, or what I call the trade-off viewpoint, that anything is legitimate as a preliminary candidate. Prima facie, anything goes. And then you make a list. Down one side is the good, and the other is the bad consequences, and then you try to decide. Now, this is a hopeless approach to ethics, this trade-off of the good against the bad. It is not true that prima facie, anything goes. The objectivist point of view is that there are moral principles to guide your behavior. And that before anything can even get on the column, it has to be in accordance with all the virtues. In other words, you have to be able to show that you are in accordance with reality. Once it's in the category of being virtuous, then a trade-off is very desirable. Then you have to decide, well, I've got a lecture to go to, but I'm very tired. So on the one side I'll get knowledge, but on the other side I'll get sleep. And you know, you can play it back and forth and make a decision. That's okay if you call that a trade-off. But you cannot have a trade-off de novo. You know, as though you're a baby, you know from nothing, now let's list advantages and disadvantages out of context. There is no way anyway to know how to pick between the two sides of your chart without principles. And without, in other words, all that finally ends up is you make your two lists, and then you just go by what you feel. So it's a completely corrupt idea that morality is an issue of trade-off. And I think one of the most important statements that I made on my own, or connections right on this point, is the second last paragraph of 342. Now, I don't very often italicize whole sentences. I'm of the school that believes that italics are guilty until proven innocent. So I constantly try to eliminate italics. And then if a whole sentence stays in, that has to tell you that I really think it's important. And this is a connection that I made, I think is one of the best in the book. It's the tie-in between ethics and what topic from epistemology? What topic is actually referred to in the first half of this italicized sentence?
The arbitrary.
The arbitrary, right. And what I'm saying here is that the need of principle in action is exactly the same as the need of proof in cognition. In cognition, if you just assert something out of context with no basis, that's called the arbitrary, and the whole point was it's neither true nor false. It's outside of cognition. It simply has to be jettisoned. It can't enter your mind if you're rational. Well, the exact same thing is true. If you declare a goal arbitrarily, without reference to reality, without concerning yourself with does it obey the virtues or not, is it pro-life or not, you just have a goal. You cannot say good or bad. It's just like the arbitrary. It's outside the realm of evaluation. You simply can do nothing with it. And I think that's a very good tie-in between epistemology and ethics. Now, then maybe somebody in this room can answer this question. This paragraph that starts with Jesus, you see three from the bottom? I did not have that in this chapter, and I delivered part of it at a Jefferson School some time ago, and some student, a man, came up to me afterwards and said, isn't that like Jesus' quotation? And I said, you know, you're really right. And I went home and thought about it. I decided that was, you know, a really worthwhile point. I put it in, and I never found out who it was. Is he here by any chance, the person who did that? Well, it's too bad, but there was definitely somebody at a Jefferson School conference, so he gets the credit. I mean, I wrote it, but he put the idea in my mind, and it was a very helpful point. All right, we'll take any questions on honesty.
Dr. Pickoff, to what extent can and should virtues become part of one's psychological makeup?
To what extent can and should virtues become part of one's psychological makeup? Well, certainly they should become. They can never be automatized, because if they were completely automatic, there would be no issue of choice. You know, for instance, take productiveness. I couldn't just automatically learn that in some form or integrate it in some form so that I woke up each morning and went to work with no further effort or choice. But it should certainly be the case that they become what Aristotle called second nature. Now, your first nature is the nature that's given you by reality. And the second nature is the character you create by means of your conclusions and reiterated action on it. Reiterated actions. In other words, if you want to make productiveness second nature, it's not enough to go to work for a week and say, okay, you know, I'll finish off with productiveness now. You have to do it as a continuous way of life. And if you do, at a certain point, it becomes much easier and much more natural. And in that way, it's, if I understand you, it's integrated with your psychology. Also, if you have premises in your mind, subconscious usually, that clash with the virtue, you have to get rid of them in order to integrate the virtue. If you're brought up, for instance, to believe that only the poor work, and you have to, you know, so that you have a certain disdain for working, and you have to learn what's wrong with that and deliberately reject it. So you may have barriers of that kind. So, yes, you can make it natural, but you can't make it automatic. Does that answer? Okay.
Dr. Peter, on page 344. 344.
Third paragraph.
Third
paragraph. Necessary to protect one's privacy.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Somebody phones you up on the telephone, either an acquaintance or you know, a stranger, and says, "I've often wondered whether you're having an affair with Mr. X, and suppose you are." Rightly or wrongly, I don't know whether you're married or not, and your immediate reaction is none of his business. But it's a context in which if you simply said, I don't want to answer, or it's none of your business, it will suggest an answer that, you know, is none of his business. In a case like that, you have every right in the world, and this comes from Ayn Rand directly, to say whatever will put the person off the trail. You are not depriving him of any value which is rightfully his, but he is trying to deprive you, not by force, but nevertheless trying to deprive you of a true value, which is your privacy. And you are entitled to your own privacy. You do not owe the truth to random questioners, including especially government agents, who may ask you, for instance, you know, do you have any other sources of income? What are you going to say? I really don't care to discuss that. Privacy is a definite value, and you cannot count on somebody else's honesty if you are barging in and intruding where you don't belong. And the consequences are on their head, not on yours. Now, there are still other cases where you can make a case for the necessity of lying or the advisability of lying, but that's why I said it belongs in a treatise on ethics. For instance, Miss Rand used to argue that there was a stage of illness in which a doctor was justified in lying to a patient. Suppose the patient was at a critical point and his own strength was a factor in healing, in whether he would get cured. And the doctor judged that the blow he would receive from hearing what he had would push him over, and that he just didn't have the strength, the use of his faculties to the extent to be able to cope with that kind of crisis, that he was justified in lying. And then he'd apologize later and say, I just didn't think you could take it, you know, at that time. So there are tricky cases. You can, especially, you want this, you don't need me, go to any seminar in ethics. They will give you hair-raisingly complicated cases where, you know, you could make a case, but you couldn't, and you get really involved. That's why I said you could write a whole treatise. But we don't need to know that. Once we have criminals, dictators, and nosy people, that basically takes care of it. All right, I'm going to go on to justice now. Now, the virtue of justice is really a tremendous compilation or distillation of points that are spread all over the objectivist literature. The need of moral judgment, which is a theme running throughout Ayn Rand's writings, how to pass moral judgment, the evil of psychologizing, the issue of the earned versus the unearned, the traitor principle, and I think the good thing about this virtue as I've done it is not that any given point is particularly new or illuminating, but simply collecting everything that pertains to justice from all that material and organizing it step by step according to PIE. So you have it all. Here's the principle, here's the intellectual side, here's the existential side, and that was the achievement of this virtue. It's kind of condensed, unified, and laid out step by step. Now, as far as any more, I liked on page 346, I may say as a formulation, that justice is allegiance to those who have sworn allegiance to life. It's the policy of preserving those who preserve life. Because I thought that named something, you know. That was 346, the second paragraph. And this, I thought, was a valuable elaboration on 349, speaking of justice in action. The second last paragraph, near the end, where I say the principle is the same. Justice in action consists in requiting the positive in men with the positive and the negative with the negative. I thought that was a clarifying way to put it, and tying it into an eye for an eye and so on. And then the validation. And I stopped to think to myself, well, why? What is the rationale or the justification of a positive going to a positive? I mean, it seems obvious, but if you tried to say, why is that the necessary policy, that you reward a positive with a positive? And it occurred to me that that is in the very nature of morality. Morality is mandated by reality. It demands that you act a certain way to achieve a certain goal. And virtue is the policy that leads to those goals. In other words, that leads to pleasure, value, the positive. Well, if that's, and vice is what leads to death, destruction, harm, loss, pain. Now that much is metaphysical. You cannot get away from that. Therefore, human beings have a choice in their behavior and institutions. They're going to accept the metaphysical principle as part of their own behavior or not. And the not has to mean they're going to reverse it. And they're going to, therefore, you know, give a negative to the man who embodies the positives and vice versa, which, of course, would be completely anti-life. You couldn't live that way if it were consistent. Now, on 350, on the third paragraph, I had a question here which I happily resolved, but I had a moment of thinking to myself, well, now I have shown what other men have a right to expect from you. In other words, justice. To be just to others, this is what you should do to them and for them. On the other hand, under selfishness, I said, you should only do what benefits yourself. Now, can I prove that what they're entitled to is exactly what your selfishness demands? In other words, I have to integrate justice and egoism. And I had a moment of thinking, what if they don't mesh? You know, what if justice demands that you give him X, but you have to be unselfish to do it? Well, it couldn't be, but I finally worked it out. So I put it in an explicit statement in case anybody else had that problem. Turning now to the question, this is paragraph 3350. What rewards and punishments do men deserve to receive from one another? The answer is precisely what each man's rational self-interest requires that he give. So however you look at it, from the point of view of the recipient who has certain things coming, or the giver who is giving, there has to be and can be no conflict. Because each of the things that people have a right to expect from you are things you must do for your own self-interest. that, I think, is... All these things are so clear once you get them. And I think I had one... Oh, yes, on 352, I made a... This is my own distinction, and I don't... I think it's mandatory, but I find it helpful, between the deserved and the earned. Now, these are often used synonymously, but I found it helpful. On 352, I distinguish. The broader of the two is the deserved, and that pertains to the status of a claim. Does the person have a right to this or not? Is it deserved or not? But then I use the word earn for the process by which you reach that state. If you enact the necessary cause, then as a result you deserve a certain thing. And I call the process of enacting the cause earning, you see. So I don't use them as synonymous. I use them, one is the consequence of the other. But I don't, that is not a distinction that you have to observe, but it enables you, if you put it that way, if you make that distinction, you can utter a sentence like I wrote in italics there in the third last paragraph. A man deserves from others that and only that which he earned. Now, of course, if you use the two as synonymous, that makes hash of the sentence, but I think I made clear by that point. In other words, there's nothing that you deserve just because you're there like a bump on a log. To deserve something from others, to have a claim on something, you have to do something. And that what you do is the process of earning it, you see. And therefore that ends the idea of the deserving poor. The question is, if they're deserving, what do they do to earn the status of being deserving? The fact that they're poor doesn't make them deserving. The only last point I want to mention to you on 355, the very last topic, which is egalitarianism. You see, I assume that this is worse than communism. Communism was a perverted, alleged attempt at instituting justice. You know, the poor had been expropriated and exploited unfairly and so on, the proletariat. But at least there was a veneer and an invoking of justice. Egalitarianism is a complete throwing away, the complete repudiation of justice in open terms, and therefore it's definitely worse than communism. And that would be my answer to these libertarian types who say, well, freedom is at last safe in the world because communism is dying. Now, it may or may not be true that communism is dying. I think it's historically too early to tell. But even if it is dying, that does not make freedom secure, because there's a lot of things around to take away freedom besides communism, and the most blatant one in this country is what they call that PC, politically correct movement, which is a version of egalitarianism. That is definitely worse than communism, and as I indicate here, would mean the annihilation of mankind. Not just its enslavement, but the actual annihilation, which I think is what the advocates are after. So this idea that we're now safe because Moscow is collapsing, which I've heard libertarians, well, I don't hear libertarians directly, but through third parties have told me that, is as fantastically superficial an idea as I could imagine. I just wish it were true that the threat to freedom in the United States was Moscow. The threat is Harvard, infinitely more than Moscow. Okay, Dan, we'll have some questions on it.
The term compromise, a stolen concept, when you apply it to compromise on principle, because there really is no such thing as a compromise on principle, you either adopt one or its opposite.
Well, that's true. Technically, you can't compromise a principle, you can only abandon it. But you can distinguish two forms of abandoning a principle. One, for instance, the principle of free enterprise. One form of abandoning it is to be a communist and say, down with private ownership, you see. Now, you wouldn't say about such a person, he's compromising free enterprise. He has explicitly abandoned it. The other would be the Republican method of saying they're all for free enterprise, except if it involves management labor, you know, farming, education, or entertainment. Now, you would say about a thing like that, normally people would say, well, we have to compromise. Now, you're correct that that implies the repudiation of the total principle. So it's interchangeable philosophically with communism. But there's a difference between the implicit and the explicit of how much, and also a difference of time. The communists enslaved you tomorrow, and the Republicans need another couple of terms. So it's that distinction that is preserved linguistically by saying the one compromises. It suggests that he holds the principle, but inconsistently. I grant you, you could make a point that it's misleading, because it suggests that you can have half of it. But there's really no way linguistically to give a whole philosophic interpretation, so I've learned to live with it as it's presently used. But I see your point. Yeah.
Steve?
In your previous section, you talked about how evil depends on not about blurring black and white. And yet, repeatedly in life, I come across people who say, you're going black and white on me, or don't be black and white. I wonder what underlies that feeling against looking at the world as black and white.
Oh, why do people object to looking at the world in terms of black and white? Well, because that's another way of saying you're passing moral judgment. Black is bad and white is good. And that means you are approaching the world from the perspective of moral absolutes. You are saying certain things are the way they should be and other things are wrong. And that could be a threat to all kinds of people. If they want to say there are no absolutes, they want a loophole. If they're afraid of moral judgment in particular, if they're afraid that an absolute morality would condemn them, or more likely would require them to condemn their husband or wife or child or whatever. In other words, if in any form they are tolerating something that they feel is less than 100% moral, then to hear you say black or white will be a direct threat to them, of exposing, making them, you know, act on what they don't want to, face their evasion. And that's very common. It's extremely common, particularly if people accept altruism as the right ethics, because then they're doomed to a sense of immorality from the outset, because you can't live by it consistently. Therefore, morality as such becomes a threat. And you just can't go around judging all the time, because then everything is wicked, including yourself. And therefore, you get rid of it by saying, well, there are no absolutes. Who can know? Let's not be black and white. The term also is more applicable, is more broadly applicable to skeptics, not just related to morality, who don't want yes or no answers. You know, either they don't believe that any such answers are possible, or they feel it would be too confining. And I've known some very, very intelligent people, extremely intelligent, who simply will not accept the idea of an absolute. And I stopped at a certain point even speculating about the motives. There's one person I'm thinking of, not in this room, that not in objectivism at all, but I know that is extremely intelligent, to the best of my knowledge, honest, and regards absolutes with utter disdain. And he's just impenetrable on that point, and I don't think he's dishonest. And he has some unbreakable linkage between the absolute and the mystical. And you can't, he's not philosophical enough to be able to step back and challenge that linkage, you see. So, I mean, it's hard for me, you're really asking a psychological question, and I've tried, if you notice, I tried to keep all of that out of this book entirely. I don't think I made one place where I said, the reason people reject this is because, and then give some psychological reason. It's purely, what is true or what isn't? You have to go to a psychologist rather than a philosopher to find out why do people want to believe something different. We got a big enough job here just to say what is correct, let alone why people don't accept it. And I'd like to keep those as two separate issues, you see, because one is philosophy and one is psychology. Okay, I think I'm going to jump on. Oh, it's three. Well. We got to whip through productiveness and pride at one time here. Now, productiveness is a straightforward, basic objectivism. It goes all the way back to Rourke's speech. And, of course, what I think the main thing I do is try to tie it to all the other virtues to show you that the reason that we venerate producers is because production is not an amoral, quote, know-how. Ayn Rand hated that word, know-how. She looked at it the same way as the instinct of tool-making, you know. I indicate in the chapter why every other virtue is essential to creating a man who can produce. And of course, the essence of objectivism is to focus on the spiritual, the moral meaning of productiveness. As far as new material, the part that's really new here in productiveness is the last part on purpose. Starting on 360, I chew what purpose means. Now, you know that in Galt's speech, he says there's three cardinal values: reason, purpose, self-esteem. But I remember going to Ayn Rand once and saying, well, you never say very much about purpose as such. Is there anything to say about purpose other than just, you should have one? What exactly do you mean? And she gave me what I just recapitulated here. I took notes as fast as I possibly could. And why it's, the issue is broader than simply your career. And that's developed from page 360. And all of that comes one way or the other from conversation with Ms. Wren. And then why that leads to the need of a career. Why you couldn't have a purposeful life without a career. And the I'm happy to have this point in book form, because you know the only place where Ayn Rand had elaborated this point in the total objectivist literature? In the Playboy interview. So the only proof of the evil of a Playboy was in Playboy magazine. So I took that whole hog from, you know, that interview and put it where it belonged under the productiveness and purpose here, so that once and for all it becomes a legitimate part of objectivism. But that was what's so fantastic, is you get an utterly essential point like that within some interview somewhere, and of all places there. Now this is a good paragraph here, paragraph 4, that just as you need a standard of value so you can judge what is or isn't of value, so in daily life you need a purpose, a specific purpose, so you can decide what to do among all the various things that are confronting you. And I found that to be absolutely true in reality. I've always had a definite purpose, a productive purpose in daily life, and when one finished, the next picked up right away. And last January, I found myself for the first time with no productive purpose. I just was sitting there, I'd finished the book, and I had no further thing planned. And I just thought, well, I will sort of coast for a while and do some things that I have wanted to do without, sort of like as a vacation, but staying at home, and just see what, you know, happens. And it was impossible. I mean, I soon found that I was busier than I had ever been, and I had no idea why I was doing one thing, you know, at this time rather than the next, and I was at the mercy of, you know, well, if the teacher of something said, can you come at 8:30? Okay, why not? If some other thing was meeting it, all right, I would do it then. And I just, the whole thing was unmanageable. I had no way to know what to do, when, and I had much too much. I just kept saying, okay, you know, or I'll try this too, and I was running frantically. And till I finally got a new long-range commitment out of myself of what I want to do in the productive realm. And as soon as that became central, and it took for several months, then everything, certain other things I cut out right away. Other things were relegated to evenings, or, you know, every third week. And it fell into a perfectly reasonable life because there was some standard to decide what do I want to do. But if I had 12 things I wanted to do, you know, it was just a frantic chaos. So it actually works out in practice if you try it. I think we're going to go right on to, I mean, I like some things here, but I'm not going to take the time on them. Let's go on to pride, which starts where? Here, it's on the top of 364. Well, this is really very straightforward objectivism. Moral ambitiousness was Ayn Rand's own phrase to describe pride. And there's a lot in the literature about this virtue. So I think one of the better points is the third last paragraph on 368, the third last in regard to pride. Why any serious code of ethics has to uphold the virtue of pride. If it wants people to take it seriously, because if it advocates certain virtues, then inherent in that is it expects people to practice them. But inherent in that is people are going to feel a sense of self-congratulation. I did it. I achieved the good. I practiced what was right. And therefore, they're going to be proud and have self-esteem. So if anybody says, I believe in morality, but not in pride, that is a direct contradiction. It's like saying, I believe you should do something, but don't ever think that you did it. I mean, that's absurdity. And that's a good line if I say so myself at the very end of the sequence there, that you need a breathing space from anti-life codes of ethics, but you don't need a breathing space from breathing, you know, which there means the process of self-sustenance, including all the virtues. Now, I'm going to put over force until Monday I did force it at an earlier Jefferson School anyway, but I'll say a few words about that because we have a short chapter, chapter 9, for next time, so we'll make the peculiar juxtaposition of force and happiness as the topic. But we have a couple minutes, I think, for because we're going to a quarter to.
What's the new long-range purpose?
No, I want to defer that. I was asked that. I don't mean to keep doing this, but I don't want... I'll say something on Saturday about that. Something, yeah. I want to be able to say it and then take off. Yeah.
The use of the word pride to mean moral ambitiousness confused me a bit. It's also that one refers to pride as pride in what one has achieved.
Yes.
So is there a distinction here?
Yes. The word pride, you're entirely correct, is used in a number of different ways, and in some uses it's just synonymous with self-esteem or self-value. Broadly, like you could say pride in yourself, or it can mean simply a sense of satisfaction at something you have accomplished. Pride in your work, you're proud of your bridge game, you know, whatever it happens to be. But she is using it as a virtue, not as a value, you see. And it's certainly a value to feel a sense of self-congratulation. That's, if you use the term pride, which you can, that's using it as a value. But remember, this is one of the virtues, and a virtue is a course of action. A virtue is that which you do to achieve a value. Now, considering pride in that sense, it means committing yourself to the good in every respect, not settling for anything less. That's what she means by moral ambitiousness. And then that involves a certain intellectual course and a certain existential course. So you're right, that is not the commonest usage of pride. But there is some, I think, linguistic warrant for it, because it's the type of man who will not settle for less than the best is a proud man, you see. And you think of a character being a proud character in fiction. You don't think of him specifically as saying how great his work is or his bridge game or whatever, but he has an arrogant attitude toward life in the sense that he will never settle for less than the best, because if it's less than the best, it's not good enough for him. It's that usage of proud, you see, that he won't take anything less than the good, and therefore in terms of his own character, than the complete obedience to what he regards as the good. That's the sense of it. It's pride as virtue, not as value. Which doesn't make the other usage wrong, but that's what the usage is. Does that clarify? Okay. What?
If the concept is slightly different, shouldn't there be two different...
Oh, well, English is... All languages are full of that because they're so close to each other. You see, in actual reality, anybody who practiced the virtue would feel the value. So it would be very common to describe the person as proud, and you wouldn't even, you know, get to distinguish between, are you talking about his action or the consequence, because they're inextricable in reality. It's extremely common in any language that a word proliferates, and there's no use putting another word in, because often you do more harm than good. Suppose you said, well, let's call that sense of self-congratulation ishkabibble. Now you've severed linguistically the connection to the process, and then you go around wondering, how the hell do you get this ishkabibble? You know? So there's no way to win. Language is just neutral. In itself, it won't confuse you or help you. Unless you define, and you'll find very often there's these two senses that are interconnected because the phenomenon in reality is interconnected. Well, we've run out. Okay, thank you very much, and we'll continue.